this is where a lot of the arguments in ecological economics have come about, right? It's the question is, does offsetting legitimize losses that would otherwise not be legitimate? Huge question.
Hello, and welcome to Economics for Rebels, the podcast of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Up until recently, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered and the earth was finite. This rebellion must bring a major shift to economic thinking. Our podcast is dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations in conversations with scientists, experts, activists, pushing for rapid and radical change for people and planet. Welcome to our podcast. I am today's host, Alexandra Köves, and you are listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. Currently, markets determine most of what happens around us. But markets have no morals. Everything is up for grabs. If you have the money, you can turn wetlands, forests, or any other biodiversity-rich areas into monocultural agricultural lands, human habitats, or mines, all in the name of development. But can we and should we compensate this by making the developers pay for biodiversity conservation somewhere else? This is the central question around biodiversity offsetting, and in his research, today's guest, Sophos Tuamgassen, has been keen to understand if it's possible to design nature markets in a way that satisfies both ecological and financial objectives. And if not, what's the alternative? Sophos is an ecological economist, a researcher in the Interdisciplinary Centre for Conservation Science at the University of Oxford. He's working on topics broadly related to biodiversity finance, UK environmental policy, biodiversity compensation, infrastructure sustainability, nature-positive organisations, and post-growth economics. In 2022, he was listed in the ENDS report as one of the 100 most influential environmental professionals in the UK. His voice is not unknown to our listeners, as he has hosted many of our Economics for Rebels podcasts. Welcome, Sophos.
Thanks so much for having me, Sandra.
I'm really, really happy that we can start season three of the Economics for Rebels podcast with you. It's been great to have you as a host on our show. And now our listeners have the chance to get to know more about your work. But I must say, you really have jumped into one of the most controversial topics of ecological economics, offsetting. I think this is a place where most ecological economics would argue with each other, whether it's good or not, or shall we do it, shall we not do it? Should we use markets that we despise for so many reasons, but for our own purposes? Actually, can we put a price to nature? Can we put a price tag to ecological losses? Should we ask for more money instead of just banning any further ruins to our ecosystems? So many questions and so many contentious answers. Can we start with that? What is your understanding of why we might need offsetting at all?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a good question. So, I mean, first thing to say is I ended up in this stuff by accident, right? It's not that I'm pro offsetting or anything like this. I did a PhD, and this was the topic that I focused on and that came with my funding. And you know, I'm not pro offsetting. I write papers that go into detail and explore how to make existing biodiversity compensation policies better. Ones that already exist, policy tweaks to make these things more effective for delivering biodiversity outcomes. And I write papers on the need to transition to a steady state infrastructure stock, right, that doesn't rely on biodiversity offsetting or any form of offsetting anymore. So this is not that I have some kind of pro-offsetting agenda. In fact, like, I'm very much one of the critical voices from the ecological economic community that enters these kind of policy discussions and then tries to bring ecological economics into these kind of policies. So in answer to your question, why we might need offsetting at all, yeah, the way I conceptualize of this is that it's a fundamental premise of ecological economics that there is a fundamental material and energetic component to all activity, right? to everything, to just existing. You know, we use materials, resources in just existing. I mean, that's the whole premise of socioeconomic metabolism. And so there is a fundamental material component to our economy. And when the society's consumption is already exceeding, you know, the capacity of the Earth's systems, ability to restore resources and to absorb our wastes, then I think it makes sort of logical sense that we might need mechanisms to undo some of the impacts of our material consumption. And there's some common empirical work that kind of that looks at this. So, for example, there was a paper published last year, which was a biodiversity footprinting exercise of a really big organization. In this case, it was the University of Oxford, led by some colleagues of mine. And what they did was implemented methods for working out the biodiversity footprint embodied in the material consumption of this massive organization. And they ran a bunch of different scenarios to get to answer the question, is it possible for, you know, a big organization to have no impact on nature overall? And what we see is that even when you implement all of the ecological economists' sort of dream list of policies, all the things that I would support, right, which is banning flying, banning the consumption of meat, restricting the consumption of any kind of resource-intensive agricultural commodities or building commodities, essentially eliminating new construction within the university. So the ecological economist's dream wish list of the kind of public policies that we can do to reduce our demand and consumption. Even after that, what you see is that, you know, the fundamental metabolism of that organization still required, even through these demand reduction measures, you are still left with about a third of the biodiversity footprint of the organization remaining. And that is purely, you know, devoted to critical activities, the things that are fundamental to that organization's purpose. So that's essentially like purchasing the materials, the biomedical equipment for fundamental research and all of these kind of things. So even after implementing the ecological economists' wish list of policies, there is a fundamentally large material component to our economic activity. And therefore, I think it could make some logical sense that we need some mechanisms to undo some of the damage of just existing, you know?
But then there's the problem. I mean, I perfectly understand it, but there's the problem that the way we think now is once you start giving this option to the market, they will say, well, I'll just offset the other two thirds as well. And I think that's the major question here.
And I totally agree, right? So there's, and this is where a lot of the arguments in ecological economics have come about, right? It's the question is, does offsetting legitimize losses that would otherwise not be legitimate? Big question, huge question, been explored theoretically a number of times, not really been answered empirically. And I've seen contexts from specific offset systems where that is definitely the case. And I've also seen contexts where that's not necessarily been the case. And so, you know, it's a really, really interesting discussion, right? Does even having the option of offsetting legitimize doing harm in the first place? And of course, that's not at all what I would advocate for as an ecological economist sitting in these policy circles, right? And we can talk about this later, but a lot of my work talks about the hard limits on economic expansion, right? That should come if you're actually going to justifiably use offsetting as a policy, right? It's hard limits to economic expansion first, and then repairing the damage that's an inevitable part of the socio-metabolic process through offsetting. That would be my way of conceptualizing how it could be used effectively. Is that how it's used in practice now? No, absolutely not, right? But I don't think that's necessarily a fundamental critique of the mechanism.
Could you maybe just quickly run us through what kind of offsets there are for biodiversity? And just to make it more tangible for listeners, let us imagine I'm a tech company and I'm in dire need for some rare mineral to satisfy the cravings of the so-called green growth. Can I open a mine? Can I compensate for the damages that I'm doing? And if yes, then how? If I can offset it, how can I offset it?
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, there's in conservation science, I sit in this world between conservation science, nature conservation and ecology and ecological economics. And in conservation science, people have written about and defined processes where basically like offsets are ecologically justifiable, as in where it is theoretically possible through the right set of management measures to recreate an ecological community that is lost. right? And those specific conditions are, you know, if it's a very common habitat type, so if it itself is not threatened, and if it restores relatively quickly, so with management measures, with a reasonably high degree of certainty, you are able to deliver that kind of habitat again. So those are the kind of situations under which there is a scientific ecological basis for biodiversity offsetting. And of course, like what we see around the world is it's applied well outside that context in lots and lots of places. So again, terrible uses of offsetting. But there are also some specific uses where it does satisfy those kind of ecological criteria. So, I mean, let's take you through three specific cases, right? So you asked about mining for the purpose of rare earth minerals for the supposed renewables transition. And yes, there's a very, very high profile biodiversity offset in Madagascar associated with the Ambatovi mine, which is a nickel and cobalt mine. It represented the largest ever essentially infrastructure investment in Madagascar. And associated with that specific mine, they set up four new protected areas to basically protect existing areas of forest and reduce the deforestation rate there. So that the mine, the deforestation associated with the mine led to a certain amount of deforestation, and the offsets prevented that amount of deforestation. And actually, there's been some interesting empirical work recently that showed that it did work for that specific purpose. It did prevent, or the offsets are on track to have prevented more deforestation than was caused by the mine itself. Now, that is not a wonderful case study, because it also came with, there's a bunch of work showing that had super inequitable social impacts and costs distributed across local communities. So that's a system that where there was theoretically demonstrated some success ecologically, but I don't think anyone would argue that it demonstrated success socially, right? But that's one example of an offset. In the UK, at the end of this year, the UK is introducing a new biodiversity compensation market under a policy called the Biodiversity Net Gain. And I've been doing a lot of work empirically exploring what the actual outcomes of this kind of system are. And what we see in this system is what I would say is largely ecologically justifiable offsetting. So most of the kind of habitat trades that we see here are buildings, housing developments, etc., being constructed on mostly pasture or cropland, so things that are intensely managed for agriculture of relatively low ecological value. And these things are being replaced by essentially promises of semi-natural grassland or wildflower grasslands in the future. So there's a lot of my work has looked at whether or not those promises will actually materialize. And that's a slightly separate question. But for me, that ecological trade is actually ecologically justifiable. Like swapping intensively managed cropland for semi-natural grassland is a sensible upgrade for biodiversity in a sense, right? And then if we look at another offset system, take Australia. They've got these native vegetation offsetting policies. And these have been widely demonstrated to have been very unsuccessful from an ecological perspective. So the way they work is they have native vegetation across the whole of Australia. Australia is a fascinating country. It's probably, in my view, the saddest case of biodiversity loss in the entire world, because it has some of the highest rates of deforestation, but also some of the highest GDP per capita. So it somehow has all the resources to be able to deal with some of the fundamental drivers of biodiversity loss, but it's exacerbating them anyway. So Australia is a really interesting and sad case from a nature conservation policy perspective. And the offset system there, the way it works is you're allowed to cut down native vegetation if you protect existing native vegetation elsewhere. And basically, I've done some work and colleagues have done some work demonstrating that that policy process across a bunch of the states has fundamentally not delivered. It's basically protected areas that would never have been cleared anyway. So it's not, you know, that's not a justifiable offset for the stuff that's been lost in the first place. So anyway, I hope that's a little bit of a tour of, you know, various kinds of offsets, places where they're obviously applied outside the realm of what is defensible by anyone, you know, other than project proponents who benefit commercially from it, but also some context where I think it's ecologically justifiable. And then the question of whether or not it's socially or ethically justifiable is, I haven't fully made up my mind on that yet.
Can you just quickly talk us through what happens when we require offsetting for compensation? Like, do people just, or developers, do they just pay in cash to some other organization who would do the offsetting, or would they be required to arrange for the offsetting themselves? Basically, what I'm trying to ask is it something where people who do the offsets, they are just kind of paying for their conscience? Or is it something where they actually have to actively get engaged with?
Yeah, that's a good question as well. Yeah, and I think the motivations when people engage in offsetting is right. It's also like, for me, it's a key determinant of whether or not it's ethical. And if it's a simple payout in order to to shift your liability onto somebody else thoughtlessly, you know, without any kind of conscious understanding of the damage that you're inflicting on the living world and the trade that you're making there, then like for me, that's just not ethically justifiable. But okay, so various systems across the world work differently. Some you have kind of developer-led compensation where they got to do the thing themselves. And most systems that I'm aware of now are converging on a system where a developer pays for an offset that is implemented most frequently by a farmer. Actually, most frequently you're paying for management measures on private land elsewhere. In the US, it works a bit differently. You pay, most commonly you pay into a sort of privately run compensation bank. So people buy up land, restore a bunch of wetlands, generate credits, and then sell them to developers. But so most of the systems that I see around the world now are converging on this system where you damage and then you pay for a credit somewhere else to generate the gains elsewhere.
You mentioned some of the research that you were doing on offsets when you tried to find out whether they actually work or not. And you mentioned some of the examples previously, but if you had to answer whether they generally work, offsets, do they?
Yeah, I mean, there's a complicated answer to this. And the simple answer is there is a decent track record of recreating the same kind of ecology when you're destroying something that's really simple and rubbish and replacing it with something that's quite simple and rubbish. So if you review the kind of outcomes of offsets, we see that there's reasonably high success rates at recreating sort of damaged wetlands in the United States or in Canada. And they've got a reasonably good record of when they build on a kind of damaged, degraded wetland, they can recreate a damaged, degraded wetland elsewhere. And those things are actually, it demonstrates success, but that's partly because the baseline is so low, right? It's partly because the thing that's being damaged is already quite degraded. So decent success rates for wetlands in North America. The way that you measure success also determines what your answer is, of course. So far the success rates in the kind of stuff that we think it's conventionally applied in, woodlands and stuff, has been low. I'm only aware of a single study actually that's demonstrated a biodiversity offset that successfully worked when it was offsetting impacts to woodlands. And that is bad news because there's a big database of all of the biodiversity offsets in the world that was collected by Joe Bull, who was at Kent and is now at Oxford. And that shows that about 2/3 of all of the world's offsets are in woodland ecosystems. So, you've got almost no evidence that they've worked in the areas where they've most frequently been applied. Yeah.
Okay. While I'm listening to you, and anytime I think of this topic, I can kind of hear Vandana Shiva's or Clive Spash's voice behind me saying that no matter what you talk about, the overall notion of offsetting is just impossible to argue in terms of morals. But let's just put these voices aside and take a very pragmatic point of view. You said, from what you've seen, okay, once we've ruined something, it's not very difficult to compensate this for something else that we've already ruined. But when we're ruining something that is a true loss, then we can't even compensate for that. This is what I gathered from what you were saying.
Yeah.
So just from a very pragmatic point of view, can you see any potential way that offsetting could work? Can we change it, putting aside the moral reasoning? Could we actually change it so that pragmatically it works?
Yeah, I see. I think that theoretically, offset systems can work, right? But it entirely depends on the way that you design them. So if I designed a biodiversity offset system, that would work. It would immediately prohibit the damage to any existing ecosystems that are rare, threatened, valuable, slow growing, right? So already that means that my criteria are way more stringent than nearly any offset policy in the world, right? Bam. And so that would be something that I think is ecologically justifiable. So you'd say, you know, no harm whatsoever to any kind of ecological systems that cannot easily be recreated and that are that are threatened or uncommon. Step one. Then step two is you got to design a governance system. So when people buy a credit, what we've seen around the world is these things have really low compliance rates. So as soon as that credit happens, it kind of gets swept under the rug. And when people go back to visit the sites where those offsets have, where people are saying they're doing their offsets, we see very, very low compliance rates. Either the management measures haven't been conducted. In some awful studies, they found that the offsets didn't even exist. And in many other cases, the offsets have been implemented, but just badly, and they haven't met kind of sensible ecological performance standards. And so there is ways to kind of correct this. And this is where I think the evidence makes me most critical of offsetting. I really question whether or not this governance can actually fundamentally work. So in theory, right, you can set up a monitoring and evaluation scheme that goes out and checks that the things that people are promising are actually happening, and that measures the changes in biodiversity, and that if the biodiversity gains that are being promised in the offset credit are actually not being delivered, then there is some kind of enforcement measure to ensure that some remedial action is taken, so that they have to implement new management measures to ensure that that kind of biodiversity uplift actually occurs, you know? And any ecological economist thinking this problem through could design a governance system that could actually deliver that. But when we've looked at all of these systems all over the world, and there's been a number of independent reviews of these kind of biodiversity offset systems, what we see is systematically there's been a fundamental lack of government capacity to actually run these systems. And then this brings up a really interesting question, right? Is that just because people don't realize how hard it is? Is that a deliberate tactic to defund the regulators so that it legitimizes further development? In some places, I would say in the Australian biodiversity offset systems, that is probably the case. It's really hard to prove, but there's a lot of evidence that these things have been sort of strategically underfunded to reduce their capabilities to actually do their job. In other countries, I don't know if the evidence is fully there yet, whether or not it's incompetence, just a lack of understanding, or if it's a deliberate strategy to reduce the kind of the bite of these offsetting systems. But this comes into, I think it brings in a kind of a really interesting point, right? So when you see carbon or biodiversity offsetting systems, I think there's a bunch of ways of conceptualizing it, and your attitudes towards it will depend on how you conceptualize it. So the neoclassical environmental economic approach here is that the point of offset systems is to internalize the externalities into the development process. And I have some sympathy for this view in that, in principle, I like polluter pays systems, right? That ethically, I think polluter pays makes a great deal of sense. If you can ensure that the price levels somehow actually reflect the true cost of damage, right? In that, internalizing damage into the economic system is, for me, a sensible policy, right? It reduces the incentives to do the harm in the first place, and it ensures that people actually make up for some of that damage. And then the ecological economic approach to this would be, it's not actually the internalization of externalities, right? It's cost shifting, right? It's the private sector deliberately shifting costs onto society and socialization. So they will do everything to avoid these costs. And therefore, an implicit conclusion that you might draw from that is that offsets are doomed, because whenever they actually become restrictive on development, whenever they actually truly internalize the cost of externalities into the process, then the cost shifting process will emerge, right? And these industries will then lobby and organize in order to reduce their, or to enable them to shift more costs onto society, to reduce their own regulatory burden and this kind of stuff. I think this is totally fascinating, right? Which of these two lenses is valid? Probably both in some specific contexts. In most of the offset systems that I've seen, I have more sympathy for the kind of cost shifting approach than I do for the internalizing externalities approach. Because I've been tracking some systems over time that have become weaker as a result of development lobbying, right? And so they've become less effective over time at truly internalizing the externalities into the development process.
And when it comes to this kind of governance issues, you have a paper with Katie Kedward and other colleagues, and you are arguing that no matter what, private financing and private investments will just not be sufficient to halt, let alone reverse biodiversity loss. Why is that? And if it won't be enough, what will be? Who should pay for it? Or who shouldn't pay for it if we come from the other side of the argument that there's no paying for it, you should just not do it?
Yeah, I mean, this is, again, a really, really fascinating question. So, I mean, the kind of the roots of that question come back to what is the cause of biodiversity? What is the driver? And there's this increasing narrative that the driver is because there's not enough money. There's not enough money for conservation. And that is like a super contestable assumption right off the start. So the kind of logical flow of that argument goes, there's not enough money for conservation. States are fiscally constrained and they have large debt burdens. And so we can't rely on states to meet the funding shortfall. And so we need to draw in money from the private sector. And there's lots of capital in the private sector. That's the kind of logical flow. And like every step of that theory of change is super contestable in my view, right? That doesn't make sense on so many levels. The idea that states don't have the capabilities to spend to deliver public goods and services in countries that have their own central banks, right? We know that that is not true. You know, there's all of these contested assumptions in the middle there. But so leaving those aside, why won't private finance be able to do all of the job? Well, because private finance chases market rates of return, and money will only flow into these. Into what they call natural assets, what we would call the living world, but it only flows into these natural assets, right? If they can deliver some kind of a return that's either low risk or attractive in some way, low risk or high risk but very high return, all of these kind of things. And in order to make biodiversity, right, this public good, in order to commoditize it to actually attract investment in, you go through a long performance, a process of commoditizing biodiversity. And so you have to define what it is that you're measuring, and you have to have a measurement system, and you have to, go through the performance of making sure this measurement system is robust and validating it, etc. But ultimately, at the end of these things, private finance will... Once you've defined what it is that you're measuring, then private finance might actually deliver that thing. But nature is super complex. And no matter how, you can't just reduce it into a single dimension that attracts investment and assume that that will deliver what the best outcomes for nature. So, I mean, like carbon is a really nice example here, right? If you want to deliver carbon credits, because of the ways that we measure carbon, some of the kind of ecological management measures that attract the most money through carbon financing are just like plantation monocultures because they're easy, cheap, standardized, et cetera. And lots of these will achieve zero or negative outcomes for biodiversity, right? So the way that you choose to measure nature in some way restricts, therefore, what the role that private finance can play, right? It will move into areas that have been commodified and are profitable, but it will deliver you exactly what is being measured there, And nature is so much more complex and wide-ranging than that. So that's like, that's one issue. The other issue is that if we look at what the most common sort of financial instruments for attracting money into nature restoration are these days, the most common ones are these offset markets, right? The voluntary carbon markets worth about $2 billion a year. Biodiversity offset markets around the world, they're also multi-billion, with especially developed markets in North America. Even setting all of our work aside that shows that there's really frequent compliance violations and a lack of effectiveness in delivering ecological outcomes in many, many offset systems. Even setting that aside, even if you assume that these things work perfectly, all they're doing, right, is making up for the ongoing damage of specific economic sectors. They're not doing anything to address your historic biodiversity losses, and they're not doing anything to address any ongoing biodiversity losses that aren't within the specific sectors that those policies apply to. So, these are the key mechanisms for drawing private finance into nature restoration. But that is a tiny fraction of the overall damage that's being done to nature in the economy, right? So for me, that is like why there's a fundamental limit to what role private finance can play in delivering biodiversity recovery. It's because it only applies to really specific impacts, and because it will flow into investments that are profitable, and it will select for the specific things that are being measured through that commodification process, and everything that is not being measured through that commodification process will not be delivered through private finance, in my view. That comes from public investments in public goods. So then what is the alternative, right? Outlining all of these potential critiques. Yeah, I mean, we're doing some ongoing work on this, but for me, we need to completely rethink, you know, our relationship with the living world. On numerous levels, there's all of the cultural stuff and philosophical stuff that a lot of people have worked on, moving from an anthropocentric to a biocentric worldview. But more practically, I think we have to completely change the narrative of nature recovery towards it being, you know, a public mission, a public good, and that government needs policy, coordinated policies and coordinated action to see investing in having a living world that is thriving as a investment in its people, and not just a cost to be minimized at all costs, you know, and a kind of burden on the public budget. And I think we can actually make some really good ecological economic cases why they should have this complete reorientation of their attitude towards investments in the living world. There's already papers out there that show that, you know, the economic multipliers from investing in nature exceed those of investments in agriculture, all of these kind of things. So we can build that kind of economic case. But it's also just about rethinking what the role of public policy and the state is towards creating, delivering these public goods that make everybody's lives better forever, you know?
So we really have arrived to the usual conclusion that no matter how you look at the problem, it is the inherent logic of the economy that is flawed, and tinkering with the usual tools is not going to achieve sustainability. And you also have a paper in Ecological Economics where you show this through the questions of the housing market. And basically what you're saying is not surprising to ecological economists, that further biodiversity loss can be averted by improving what we have. So no new green field investments. Not using housing as a financial asset, and establishing more equality on the housing market. And of course, all these suggestions are of post-growth, degrowth, and all sorts of beyond growth concepts. So this is something that we should demand for more biodiversity. Anything else we should demand as a movement or as activist scientists?
Yeah, I mean, great question. Yeah, so for context there, yeah, Sandra's referring to this paper we wrote last year called A Home for All Within Planetary Boundaries. And basically we simulate the ecological impacts, so the impacts on biodiversity and carbon emissions of England's housing strategy, England's current government housing strategy. And our simulations demonstrate that if England follows its own housing strategy, then housing alone will consume England's entire carbon budget, consistent with 1.5 degrees of warming, which is a bit of a problem because currently, you know, that represents less than 20% of the English economy. So that's 20% of the economy consuming our entire carbon budget if we follow business as usual trajectories. So, I mean, the policies that we make out proposed from an ecological economic perspective in the system are exactly what Sandra's just what's alluded to there. It's about greatly increasing the equity of the existing housing stock, yeah, eliminating the use of second homes, using every square meter of housing space as if it's precious, because it's all, there are embodied emissions and operational emissions, you know, emissions from heating and electricity in every square meter of the housing stock. So using all of these to meet all of our housing needs in the most efficient and equitable way possible. You know, that those are the kind of policies that we advocate. That's a tricky question, Sandra, because the degrowth and post-growth communities do propose an awful lot of policies, right? So nearly everything falls within scope of things that have already been proposed. But I think if I think about the policy avenues that make me most excited right now, as avenues for transformational change, so far I get most excited by the kind of legal changes. So that's promoting the rights of nature, promoting the right to a healthy environment as a fundamental human right, all of these interesting avenues where we can increase the opportunities for ecological litigation to fundamentally change our legal systems in favor of the environment. That I think is the stuff that makes me most optimistic and excited right now. Because there's this fundamental issue that, you know, the legal systems that we've constructed over centuries that are fundamentally intertwined as well with the history of capitalism, you know, they operationalize some ideas that I think are super outdated, right? This kind of idea of the do no harm principle. You can do whatever you want as long as it doesn't harm others. Super outdated principle in an era where every single unit of consumption harms somebody else, right? I mean, there's a paper a few years ago that quantifies the mortality cost of climate change. And its headline conclusion is that, you know, the lifetime emissions of 3.5 average American kills an additional person globally, you know, between 2020 and 2100, right? So we're talking about like existing has costs on other people. And so the idea of a legal system that assumes that you can do whatever you'd like as long as it doesn't harm others doesn't really make sense anymore when every consumption decision that you make actually does have an impact on somebody else. And so I think like the legal system needs to be fundamentally transformed to reflect our new reality of an Earth system that is at its very limit, in my view. So that's the stuff, I mean, that's mentioned within some aspects of the post-growth and degrowth community, but the stuff that I wish would be brought in more centrally is something that I find very exciting.
And last, you are not avoiding the question we ask all our guests. What is your rebellion?
Yeah, thanks, Sandra. I mean, you know, in my job, I sit on various like government advisory roles, and I advise the occasional business, and I sit, and my research is very much embedded within either financial business or policymaking circles. And I guess like, I'm just that guy. I'm the party pooper in every room, right? I'm that guy who's bringing every conversation back to consumption, the hubris of the idea of limitless growth in the financial sector, of the idea that we can constantly expand the returns that are being delivered by financial portfolios. You know, I'm that guy, the guy who is constantly, whenever anybody makes the assumption that increases in GDP are good or that increases in wealth are good, the guy who brings it back to the fundamental empirical untruth that there is a sensible relationship between increases in wealth and psychological well-being beyond certain levels of income, you know, all of these things that to try and demonstrate that their worldview is actually just not based on an empirically sensible view of how human psychology works, all of these kind of things. And then, I mean, there's other stuff I do. Like I live my lifestyle in line with my values as an ecological economist, but that's not super rebellious in the ecological economics community. That's a norm.
Well, thank you so much for this discussion. And thank you so much for being a co-host on Economics for Rebels. I think our listeners have had the chance to listen to many of your podcasts and they're truly amazing. So thanks for that as well.
It's such a pleasure, Sandra. Thanks so much.
And thanks to all of our listeners for spending time with us. Stay tuned with us for our next episode.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.